Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith. And today we are joined by Thomas Elayan and Brandy Barry Benson from the Bach and Beethoven Experience.
How are you all doing today?
We're great because really your cats good. Have come to visit us. So.
Yep. Well, the rambunctious one has been stowed because yesterday we recorded an episode and he became really enamored with his tail.
He does that a lot. And just like, that's like peak Oscar.
He just nice. Was in the middle of this like empty space right here, like jumping into the air trying to get his tail, and then just kind of like, ah, like, and I just nipped that in the bud.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to live that life.
Yeah. Well, next time you should just do a YouTube video and just have pictures of him doing that and then the audio over top of it. I think that would be really entertaining.
Just on a loop.
You get a lot that of hits for that one.
Absolutely. Yeah, oh my God. House. That's like actually not far from our current practices, honestly.
Nice. No, we're on a mission to monetize our cats.
There is a lot of market research that shows cats being incorporated and stuff will earn you revenue and hits and everything. Well, so you're right. You
have
should
you
do
seen
it.
Window Cats?
No.
I'm taking this opportunity to plug this project because I'm very proud of it. It is a currently in its 10th episode video series that I started where I just put a camera. When the cats are sitting in the window, I just put a camera in front of the cat and let the camera run. And honestly, usually they're like 10 or 15 minutes of video, and I cut out 2 or 3 minutes, and we post in the Facebook group DIY Chicago being like, hey, are you a local artist, musician, looking to like, not, basically like, are you an indie artist just looking to kind of like get your name out there more? Send us your music and we'll put it on top of this video of our cats. And it's, you know, there's a playlist. Nice. So if you go
people
to bit,
love it.
Yeah. If you go to bit.ly/windowcat, that's the playlist. And you can just play it and it's 10 episodes of, so it's like 30 minutes of music.
Of just like local Chicago music.
And I add some every few days. Like I have like kind of a 5 more at least booked or set up. Not like made, like I still have to shoot. Basically, the hard part about it right now is the cats aren't in the window lately. I don't know why that is, but
so you just throw them, get in the window right now.
Yes.
I need a video.
I've tried this, and I
can't,
but those
stage
are,
mom it.
Yeah, if you stage mom it too much, then they're like, and then they move to the other side of the windowsill halfway through, so then like the shot is just their ass. It's like really.
Oh, no.
Anyway, so check that out. Anyway,
yeah, cool.
I already asked you how you're doing.
We're here to talk about your upcoming project, Chicago Stories 2. Would you mind telling us a bit about it?
Yeah,
a bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is Chicago Stories Book 2. We're super excited about this. We have 3 new composers this year. Regina Baiocchi, Ronnie Culler, and Kurt Westerberg, and we couldn't be more thrilled. The topics. So Regina, she's from the Brownsville area, so she has some family there, and was connected with 2 women that wrote a book about the history and some of the stories that have come out of Brownsville as a result of moving there from the Great Migration. So that's been pretty cool. Ronnie Culler, we actually taught at the Old Town School of Folk Music together back in the day. And she's a great pianist, a great composer, and
accordion player too, right?
An accordion player too. Yeah, we found that out. We did these like really cool little profiles of each of the players and composers, and you know, you find some interesting facts about people, which was cool. So she lives along the Bloomingdale Trail, and so she wanted to write stories about that, stories about the 606 and all that stuff, or the Bloomingdale Trail. And then Kurt Westerberg, we worked together at DePaul University. He was the assistant dean and then is also head of the composition department there. And actually, we worked together a few years ago. He wrote his first piece that he wrote for Period Instruments was for me specifically, and harpsichord, and that was called Barocco, which was really neat. And then the BBE commissioned him to write a piece based on Orphic hymns about orbits, and this was in collaboration with the humanities department. And so we just thought, well, let's have him again, but this time let's have him for Full Out Chicago Stories. And as it turns out, he has some family ties to the Swedish immigrant community here.
Oh, cool.
So, which is super cool. His grandfather in particular moved from Sweden to Chicago and worked on the trains here and also preached at one of the Swedish churches. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he has really deep family ties. And so he came upon some of his grandfather's old diary entries and wrote a piece of music that is about the various different excerpts that of his grandfather's life that he found in those diary entries. And what's even more cool is he's going to get his brother to record those excerpts in Swedish so that those are playing over us while we're performing his pieces. So,
God.
Yeah, so it's like, it's super cool. We're so, you know, this is my, like, one of the most favorite things that we do all year, just because we get to know everybody in a whole new light, find out more about Chicago that no tour guide could ever tell you. And yeah, so we couldn't be more thrilled. And of course, we have a number of people back playing period instruments, and also we have percussion this year. And and so we have a little bit of this bluesy you know, singing as well by the awesome Felicia Patton. She'll be joining us. So she's equally at home in the blues gospel genre with her voice as she is the classical, which is pretty awesome. And so anyway, we're super stoked, just, you know, yeah, to have these different combinations coming in. And yeah, so you want to say something else, Tom?
I mean, that was pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
That was a pretty good summary of everything going on.
I mean, because that's the thing is, I can't, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording. I found myself wanting to ask a specific question, like, get into kind of, like, finer details of something, but I also feel like I very much just want to say, generally, that the work that y'all are doing is radical and groundbreaking and important, and is just kind of, like, as I hear y'all talk about it more and more, and, you know, we've had you on a couple times, like, you know, for people that come from classical music, I mean, I'm sure that maybe y'all have felt this way too. Like, it's a weird space of people that are now creating after studying it, you know, like leaving the academic space, and then the space outside of kind of like what is the, oh, I don't know, like A-list space. Do you know what I mean? Like the, like,
we are the Kathy Griffins
of the classical and
which is fine.
That's actually kind of a perfect, because cool. In some ways, isn't Kathy Griffin kind of radical? Like,
oh, how, yeah.
Like that's fascinating. That's a really good pull. But like, I guess like my point here is that I find that y'all have as an experience have picked tenets. A thing that we kind of come back to a lot, especially with folks that are kind of making multidisciplinary, is this idea that you can come from a traditional academic experience and maybe reject parts of it, maybe embrace parts of it, but or also just feel like you need to make something completely new. And I feel like that must resonate with y'all, of that experience of wanting to make something completely new. But I also very much feel that, especially being in your fourth year... How many years of this?
How old are we?
Yeah, right. Well, I guess technically, like, since 2009, but actually, I think with our current configuration, I feel like it's more like 2014.
I relate. That's, yeah. This is why I was like, I can't, I don't, because the same thing with Scoppy, where we started it, stopped.
Yeah, and then, yeah, right, exactly. So I think actually we're more like, because we started, what, like, when you and I
reconnected.
Yeah, when we reconnected and everything, I think more like 2015 was like when we first started going again.
That was the concerts. First. That was the year we actually started pushing things.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. So yeah, so I feel like we're still like, as we are, we're still like a youngish organization, but yeah.
Well, so ultimately, where I'm going with this is that
yep,
y'all have, to me, made it clear that you have tenets and guidelines that you not only strive for, but have shown in practice that you've done. And I'm curious, coming from that perspective of both kind of like striving for and acknowledging what you've done, kind of like, what are those guidelines and how have they played into to your work?
Sure. I'll jump in again.
Okay, go for it first.
So I would say, you know, I liked the way you put it, where there's like some things you know, maybe you like venture off and do something different, and some things you embrace about your training. And there's quite a lot that we still for sure embrace about our training. There's, you know, I think any time that you're going back to what Bach and Beethoven did and other, you know, composers like them, you want to pay like tribute to them. And also, I mean, the stylistic conventions, the performance practices of those times, like, they really do help to inform you in a very special way about how to do that music. And so that's something that I definitely hold very dear. You know, but I also think that it doesn't stay there. And so whatever, and I've always just kind of just thought, you know, whatever you put into something, you're going to get out of it. And so if you go in wanting to learn it the best possible way, and you want to build on top of that, not just let it just stay there, but actually that you're going to take that knowledge and go somewhere with it. That was always, you know, my heartbeat with it anyway. And so it never, for me, stayed on the page. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think a lot of, too, what we notice that's both good and bad about classical music in general. What's good is that, you know, quality is high. We want to keep quality high. Some of the things we want to change have a lot to do with experience, which is why we also changed our name to the Bach and Beethoven Experience. And so a lot of that has to do with just how we connect to our audience. What is the atmosphere we're trying to create? And we do that a number of different ways. You know, starting with obviously like programming, Chicago Stories is really big for us in that way because it's very personal. It's not something that was created in the past that we're bringing back. Mm-hmm. It's something that's being created now, literally being finished now by the composers. So I'll put that there. The other thing is too, when we consider where we're going to play, is it accessible? Can people eat and drink? Can people talk? You know, can you create this kind of atmosphere where people can really come where they are and just kind of have this, you know, feeling of escapism after a hard day's work, or like be refreshed or be inspired or whatever they're needing, we want to be able to give that to them. The other thing is, you know, how we dress. We're not like formal concert black. We try to always wear colors. We feel like that, you know, there is something, there's certainly lots of research and science has been done about that, about what you wear and like what that gives off and everything like that. So not that we, you know, like, I mean, we were going for something different. We weren't going for like, you know, how specific colors talk to people, you know, whatever. So not to go down that rabbit trail, but just, you know, to say that that's a tradition about the concert experience that we're like, you know, we're going to depart from this a bit. And then I also just think too, just the overall feel about classical music and, you know, not being afraid to mix it in a little bit with some other genres as well, with some of the other things that we do. The way we kind of describe ourselves is that, you know, the fall we have this big new music thing called Chicago Stories. For the holiday times, we have carols in a very interactive program. So we're not only researching this, you know, the music, we're researching the other traditions behind that music that maybe aren't, you know, necessarily musical traditions, but they're tied to what was going on at the time. We like to collaborate with people. So we'll do some kind of collaboration in the spring. And then in the summer, we, you know, this is another one of my favorite things we do is this folk crossover kind of program, because in my background, I grew up playing bluegrass music. So I've always had half of myself, you know, like in the folk world, and then the other half of myself in the classical world. And I'm cool with that. You know, I enjoy that. And there's a you know, I take a lot of cues from folk music that I want to show up in classical music, because folk music is probably the most social music I can think of that has no boundary between the performer and the audience member. So
I love that. And, you know, it's something that, and I'm going to butcher the, if you're listening to this show and you specifically want to find out what spectrum I'm talking about, I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's at the end of the Ethan T. Parcell episode. But we were talking with him about the idea of pretense in talking about classical music, and this idea of like how we, because it's the idea of like where I love the canon, like I love the music from the canon, but I don't love the pedestal. Mm-hmm. And I, hearing you talk about kind of your background echoes that for me, where, because in so many ways, like to think that classical musicians don't have something to learn from folk, or to learn from, you know, what is seen as below the pedestal, like that feels like foolish to me, you know, like I don't know.
Well, and I also think that like what I appreciate about how you're describing, like, for example, how you prepare for the Carols concert, like, you know, if you were to, if you know, approaching Christmas carols and not the traditions associated with them, to me feels like art in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Because like those, the music, like, you know, most like carols tell stories about like things that you do during the holiday season, and then to just kind of like leave these seemingly archaic activities and just being like, yeah, doesn't this sound nice, instead of being like, okay, like we talked about it, now let's actually do it. Like, right. I like, you know, kind of that well-rounded approach, and I think that that's an approach that you bring into a lot of your art making, which I think is so important.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have fun. I think, you know, and to that end, I mean, I don't know that anybody's played the slipper game, the hunt the slipper game at a Carol's concert before. And that was, people loved it. They totally ate that up. I mean, in our collaboration with the humanities department at DePaul, we had a wheel gymnast. I didn't even know that was a thing. Yeah. Until like we, you know, so we found ourselves, you know, in these, I mean, we've put ourselves in these different situations and we love it, you know? Yeah. And I think, you know, I go back to last year's experience in the Green Mill when we performed that, that piece of music that Eric Malmquist wrote for Iman. She's a Iraqi refugee that came over here, from a war torn country, 19 hours trekking across, you know, not easy terrain, leaving your family behind because you're their only hope, is hearing that, you know, and being confronted with a individual.
Sitting in the audience with her daughter.
Yeah, like she's sitting in the audience with her daughter, you know, the future of her family right there in the Green Mill. Yeah. And, you know, and we're performing this piece honoring her courage, you know, honoring her life, and she's here in Chicago. And, you know, that kind of impact and that kind of experience just can't be, you know, recreated. I mean, it's such a living experience. It can't be recreated by something that's written in the past. And something, you know, that I always take from our namesakes is that they were always writing, you know, I mean, it wasn't like every second of the day, right, that they're writing new music, but they were writing new music and playing their music and playing other people's music, and they took and were inspired by other people around them as well. And so there's that, you know, kind of living current experience that we're also trying to recreate as mm-hmm. well, you know, instead of just always looking to the past. My favorite composers are the ones that were, they excelled and they embraced their training, and then they took, but they didn't leave it there. They took it and then moved forward with it. And I think that's, you know, something that.
At what point did we stop valuing, at, like, as a society, at what point did we stop valuing honoring new music? Because, during the, like, people would be excited about, like, oh, well, Beethoven wrote a new thing.
Yeah, like, right. I mean, some people want to say Mendelssohn, but I don't know if that's entirely true.
Well, I remember seeing a chart, and I'll have to go back. I can send it to you guys, and it was really eye-opening for me because it was the exact same thing, but it was focused on opera. And it was, like, how many new operas were either written or premiered, you know, like in a decade. And you could, it was like, you could see it go down decade by decade by decade by decade, starting kind of, I think, in the late 1800s. Because I think at that point, then you had like, oh, well, let's just redo this one. And yada. And so now it's like, you know, an opera company like the Lyric, and I'm not knocking the Lyric, right? Like, don't hit me.
Trust me.
Don't hit me all.
The space that you're at, the mental space that you're entering right now is one that we, like, I think you can both critique and love. Yeah.
But I think there's something to be said. Like, I'm, for instance, a couple seasons ago, they premiered Bel Canto, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's great. They premiered Bel Canto, but that was one opera out of an entire season where then, I forget what all they did, but it was kind of standard rep, you know, and the fact that they only did one opera that was new when there are all kinds of new operas that are coming out, like, it has been on the decline, it seems, for the past century in terms of new stuff. And you can kind of see why people do it. Like, they get the big bucks because some mm-hmm. rich old person wants to hear Madame Butterfly again. And, okay, we have to keep the bills going and pay the artists and also pay respect for this really great work of art. But, man, there are, like, tons of really amazing artists out there creating new music right now. Mm-hmm.
In Chicago. Yeah, I think that's, like and nationally, too. I don't mean to say that it's just Chicago. But what I think is fascinating about the work that Chicago Stories is doing is, like, y'all are putting the spotlight on Chicago in a major way and finding different stories through that lens. But it is fascinating, that kind of that space that you're inhabiting. So I think there's kind of two pieces to that I want to kind of explore and know more about. The first thing is, I want to know, through that focus that you've had now since the first time you've done this and thinking about doing the annual Chicago Stories as a project, how has that changed your relationship with this city and the people that make art with it? And then the second thing is, how do you find, like, what kind of, this sounds so cliche, but like, what are the tools in your toolkit as programmers and as producers to find these to create a space in which these stories of such diverse experiences are be able to be told?
Well, I think for this, okay, well, I guess for the,
these feel kind of related, but they're also, like, giant questions, so I'm really sorry.
No, that's fine. I think for, like, what was the first question?
I think I won't forget the second one. The first question is, specifically, how has your relationship with Chicago changed as you've done this project?
Well, I don't know. For me, like, I learned all kinds of new things. Like, you know, like, there are so many different kinds of people in the city, right? And you don't think, when you're going around the city, you know, you might casually think about Pilsen, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a big neighborhood where a lot of people kind of go to, but you don't necessarily think about the Swedish residents of the city like we're doing this year. And they've made a huge contribution to the city that's just kind of overlooked. And also, you know, in part because, like, there are other things going on right now in the world. And there are other groups of people who maybe are taking the focus for specific reasons, you know, for things that are going on. So you don't think about the Chicago Swedes. But it's cool because you have all these people who are like, well, you know, but they have really great stories. And there were really amazing people who were doing things in the city. So it kind of introduces you to that. I'm really looking forward to seeing, like, what Ronnie does with the Bloomingdale Trail, because it's like, think about how many people, like, run along that thing all the time, or bike along it, or walk along it. And I live in Humboldt Park, so I walk on it, like, on my way to go do stuff and just to go see it. And you pass by all these people, and you pass by all these buildings, like, new houses, old houses, and you think about, well, this is really awesome, but then who does this also displace? Or how does this change the scenery? It's really great for the dude jogging, but, like, did it displace a family of, you know, of people who have been living here for several generations? So it's really interesting because it brings up all of these kind of overlapping peoples and ideas, the things that you don't necessarily consider that are really there.
That happens a lot in the Midwest. That actually happened. So I'm from a suburb outside of Milwaukee up in Wisconsin, and that happened like down the hill from the house I grew up in, where there was this entire neighborhood. Like there was a gas station, there was like all, and like 100 homes that all got bought up by the city. The people who lived there were given, you know, X number of days, and it was largely low-income housing. It was largely, mm-hmm. like, working-class families living down there, and they were like, cool, you've got 60 days to get out, and then they knocked down an entire neighborhood to expand a park. Mm. And, like, yeah, the park is really nice, but, like, what about all of those families? And I think that the way you're thinking about it is, like, the way to think about it, of, like, yeah, it's gorgeous, and green space is so important, and it's so important to maintain in a city, but like,
yeah.
kind of, but like, making sure that we, making yeah, sure that we, it was, it's, it sounded like, all around me.
I was like, I was like, are you segueing to a commercial? Like, yeah, what's going on? Yeah,
exactly. And now for our spot, though.
Yeah, but like, but yeah, I think that like, looking at green spaces and being like, this is amazing, but like, what was here before? And like, really honoring the history of where you are.
But that's, I think that's, it'll be interesting, because like I said, I actually don't know what Ronnie has written on that one. And gotcha. And I don't know what, I mean, I got the idea of what Kurt's written and stuff, so who knows? This is like Ronnie's perspective of this, which is going to be very different from somebody else's perspective. So I don't know what she's exploring in it. And I think that's part of the interest too, is like, you know, you can look and see like, what is she seeing? Like, what is her perspective of the world? And then you can think about it in the context of this conversation too, you know? So like, is that obviously is a part of the conversation. She's one of like 10 million stories that are floating around this area, so we'll see what happens. But it's cool because it makes you think about these things.
This actually really segues into, this is the connecting link of the first question to the second question, because so basically what the second question is like, what do you think has, like, as in your experience as producers, like, what has opened you up to these stories? Like, what, like, yeah, like, how do you feel it's been, how do you feel you've been able to communicate that these stories exist? Because I feel like it'd be really easy to not do that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it'd be like, you could, that's because that's what development is like, when a development in practice, like politically, when development is done, it displaces and doesn't acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And what I think is fascinating about the way you're thinking about this all is that there is no, you are acknowledging that there are these different stories from different angles, and that is the thing I'm curious, like, for y'all, like, is that something that you can verbalize? Is that just something that you feel like the way you're drawn to this topic is, that's inherent in it, like, does this make sense?
I think so, but I think it's more just like we just kind of give the composers free reign to pick what's meaningful to them.
Right. Yeah. I'll expand a little bit on that too. I think also, so the heartbeat of this project, because I think it's really easy as an artist to only focus on your programming, to just mm-hmm. for us to say, hey, we're going to do this new music project. It's going to be mm-hmm. about stories in Chicago, and we leave it at just that, mm-hmm. you know. And we just have people, you know, and this is not putting anything down, but just, you know, write a piece that's like an abstract idea or whatever. And I think what makes this project so special is that it doesn't just stay at being a good idea, or just, you know, it's not just a new music project. It's, you know, telling the story, you know, of living individual, a living experience that is happening right now, through music that is happening right now. And it just goes so much more beyond, you know, just being a music concert. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the focus isn't just the focus is not like, hey, we're doing a new music thing and this is our label that we're going to put on, you know, on this experience. It shouldn't be labeled, in fact, where it can be given the title Chicago Stories, but really, but what it is just human stories. We all happen to be in Chicago at the same time, and we're using music as the medium to help bring it to life. Instead of, does that make sense? Instead Absolutely. Of just saying like, hey, this is a, you know, whatever genre and just leaving it like that. I'm going to go see the Punch Brothers tonight. They're one of my favorites, not because they're, you know, awesome and everything, but I really looked at them as an example. Thomas is smirking because I use this example a lot. You know, they're not just a bluegrass band. It's not like, hey, I'm going to see a bluegrass concert tonight. You know, they've taken things way beyond that. You know, they just have a bluegrass instrumentation, but it's not just a bluegrass concert, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the difference. And I think that's also the difference with what we're doing is, like, we're not just doing new pieces of music that are just being written right now, just about, you know, something. I think it's awesome when someone writes a piece about, you know, whatever experience they've had in the past, or even if it is a present experience, you know, they were out, you know, by the ocean and they're going to write a piece about, you know, the waves or whatever. Like, not knocking that, I'm sure. And it would be a great piece. But what I think really, again, what's different is just that this is a personal connection. We're like, we're seeing, like, not only are we getting, you know, our relationship to the city does change because it changes because of that personal relationship that you're building, not just with the composers, not just the composers with the performers, but, you know, we're learning more about our neighbors. Yeah. And I think that's just like, you know, the fact that that whole personal element comes into play, like, from the very, very get-go, when the composer chooses their topic and says, hey, I want to write about the Swedish immigrant community because my grandfather moved over here from Sweden and, like, worked in Chicago, and I'm here in Chicago because my grandfather came over here mm-hmm. instead of being over in Sweden. Or, like, Regina, I'm in Brownsville instead of, you know, elsewhere because of my family ties and, you know, we've had all this history and all these great leaders come through Brownsville because of these people, and she's writing about those stories. Ronnie is, here's my perspective of Bloomingdale Trail because I live here and I walk this trail and I cross paths with these people and I intersect, and then here is how I do, you know, here is how I portray those intersections by writing these pieces. So it's like the focus isn't even almost on the music totally, you know? It's really on the experience.
I find that so fascinating. And sorry that I'm, like, just constantly going off on intellectual tangents from what you're saying.
Yeah.
But this also is, like, a mindset that I'm really glad to talk about, because it also is very much how I feel journalism. And I think what good journalism does. Because, you know, I think when, from an academic biographical standpoint, we are taught to separate the who, the what, the where, and the when from when we look at art. I think about this all the time whenever we talk about, you know, studying Mozart's life or something like that. Like, oh, well, we can't let that, we should not, I'm not saying that it should define the conversation, but I feel like there are voices in academia that say that we should look at it objectively, meaning we shouldn't include the who, what, where, when, and why. But I find that to me, it, you know, it's a conversation that I think is happening a lot in kind of popular culture, where, you know, this idea that we're not creating art in a vacuum. It's fascinating to me to think about. We were just talking with, have y'all seen these really dumb Johnny memes? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't think so.
No, we are old and out of the loop.
They're,
I guess,
really, really. I'm pretty sure they're made by a robot in India, and I don't mean that like as a cleat. Like, I'm seeing, like, I'm what? That's, I'm pretty sure that's what they are, and they're just this weird format. It's really fascinating, and also, like, basically where I'm getting at with this is it's so absurd it shouldn't be funny, but it's funny because it's so absurd. And we were just talking with Jennifer Larson about this, where it is almost that it is so escapist and so absurd, it could only happen now. And so that to me is an interesting space to be looking at things from, is this idea of what does the now mean? If we're living in a space where our art isn't being made in a vacuum, how does that... So anyway, the actual question here is... I'm so sorry that I don't know. I've had like 3 cups of coffee today, so I'm just kind of like...
Well, but this is great. Like, I think this is... Okay, so this is meaningful in the sense that shouldn't talking about art and shouldn't art itself like elicit emotions and ideas and make mm-hmm. you think about things?
Yeah.
So like, I think that that's important. I think that that's great. I'm just leaving it there for you so you don't feel...
Yeah, right. I appreciate that. The actual question is, I'm curious for y'all with the work that you're doing, the work that you've done, and the work that you set out to do. What does the current moment mean socially, you know, culturally, all that stuff? How does that play in for y'all?
Well,
I don't know. I think, you know, I like to leave it open to it can mean whatever you want it to mean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're in it, if you're there, that's why we always say, like, you know, come to our performances like as you are, and take out of it what you want, because everybody comes in needing something different.
Yeah.
Can they come in? They're coming in from a different space. And people are going to be, you know, maybe you had the day off. Maybe you had a horrible day at work. Maybe you are taking care of family. Maybe you're elderly, maybe you have 5 kids, maybe, you know, the list goes on. There are a million different ways that someone can come to one appointed time on one day. And I think that's, you know, the other thing that Chicago Stories has made me realize is that we all have much more in common than we have different. And so even though everybody's coming to the same spot in a million different ways, they're also, the beauty of it is that they're going to experience it a million different ways too. And, you know, and I don't want to say that someone, you know, should feel or that a moment should be defined for them a certain way. You know, just, I mean, if they come and like they hear the Swedish Immigrant piece and they are Swedish background, or maybe they're not, maybe they're an immigrant of, you know, of another country, and that story either brings tears or it brings happiness, you know, but or any other, like, you know, swirl of complicated emotions that it could be, or simple emotions or whatever, and also depending, I mean, it just I like to think that it could happen and be and mean to somebody what they want it to mean. And you know, we don't want to, that's the whole point, is that you don't want to label it.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's also, like, I think you guys will appreciate this one.
Yeah.
Is like kind of the current state of affairs of classical music too.
Yeah.
And Brandy and I talk about this often. I know you guys do too. Kind of like, where do we see classical music now? Kind of how is it relevant to people? What is it kind of bringing to the table? And like, there are some really strong opinions on so many sides of this one. I think I'm going to correct me, Brandy, if I'm incorrect on this one. Sure, but I think we stand on kind of the side of doing things differently. And not just saying you're going to do something kind of different, but like actually trying to do something different, right? Like we don't know any other people who are doing like take kind of merging this early music thing, but with current state of affairs in a city, you know, regularly every year annually. And, you know, and also the way we approach like concerts. Brandy said, like, the way we think about our concerts is like, even though you're doing this really amazing, what you could consider high art, in a place where people are getting drunk and or they are bringing their 5-year-old who's screaming, or, you know, they're eating like some cheesy nachos or something, and then they walk across the stage to go to the bathroom. Like, you know, all of those things, like kind of taking it down off of its pedestal and bringing it to people in a way that after a 10-hour work day, they don't feel like, I don't want to go to that concert. I just want to go home and, like, watch Friends reruns or something. You know, like let's all be honest, right? Like, half the time we really don't want to go do stuff. We just want to go home because mm-hmm. we're exhausted and we're tired. So how can we create this environment where classical music is a Beyonce concert or something where people want to actually go and spend time with people and enjoy it? And I've gotten a lot of flack from people who, and they have a valid opinion, right? Everybody has a valid opinion about this one, but like who are like, well, you know, that's not what classical music is. Classical music is this event unto itself where you go and you enjoy the music and it's all about the music. And it's like, but I don't know. I don't actually want to do that. I want it to be a different kind of experience. I want it to be something where we can go and enjoy each other and enjoy being alive. And music is just part of that whole story.
Well, because right? it wasn't... when it was originally being performed, like, people in the audience were, like, chatting and the lights were up mm. and, like, there would be, like, audible gasps and, like, you know, people, like, it used to be enjoyed much more accessibly.
Yeah.
And so when there, you know, there's... I've been a teaching artist in a bunch of different capacities, and a big thing that like the number one thing that we have to teach the kids is how to be an audience member, and being and I think that, like, yeah, you know, I think it's important that we're teaching kids not to, like, pull Sally's hair in the middle of the performance. But yes. But
I think, we would all agree on that one.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that, as you know, as children become teenagers, become adults, like, we can kind of redefine what being an audience member means. Mm-hmm. Because I think that the pressure of being a good audience member and being engaged and listening the right way, I think it's driving people just to go home because they're like, ugh, I don't have the bandwidth to sit and, you know, be respectful. I just want to burp in my living room.
Well, let's be honest. Like, you go, this is, I don't like going to perform concerts because of a lot of this. And I think I used to be ashamed to admit it, but now I'm just like, well, screw it. Like, I'm just going to tell people how I think about it. I don't like going to concerts because I don't like having to go through a 10, 12 hour day of working, of everything, and then go have to sit somewhere quietly, be afraid that when I cough, people are going to give me a dirty look because I interrupted their, like, ascendant experience of a Palestrina piece or something, you know? Like, I don't want to have to sit there and, like, be concerned that, well, I have to go pee, but I can't leave until intermission, which is another 40 minutes. Like, things like that. Mm-hmm. And you put it very, very well. Like, if you think back to, like, kind of the origins of opera, or, like, even at its heyday during the Baroque era, right? Like, the operas were on repeat and people would go, and it was more of a social event, right? So you went to go see what the singer did differently every night, and part of their reason for doing it differently was to keep you wanting to listen to them rather than being like going off and playing poker or going out in the hallway and seeing mm-hmm. who's wearing what dress is going on, or going up to the brothel that is also nearby and having like a quickie, you know? Like, these were mm-hmm. all things that were going on with the opera. And today it's a scandal to unwrap a candy bar in the middle of like some 30 yeah. minute long Wagnerian opera aria, where if for the 20 seconds that it took to unwrap it, you really still had 19 minutes and 40 seconds left of the aria to enjoy.
Hundreds of comments on that Facebook thread, right, that thing yeah, that you right. just said.
Yes.
I'm just saying, like, that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Oh, yes. And, like, and it always reoccurs, and I'm always on the one side, and then you always have the other side that's very much like, the art is precious. And I'm not saying it's not amazing and shouldn't be, you know, enjoyed, but it's like, man, like, you turn off so many people who then go to pay five times the amount to go to a Beyonce concert, buy her albums, buy her t-shirts, mm-hmm. sit there, stuff their faces with a hot dog, jump up and down, tweet it out, and then suddenly she has a bajillion fans all over the world.
Because it doesn't distract from their experience because of the way that they've let the art
affect
them. Yeah. Yeah, the being an audience member at a Beyonce concert is so much different than being an audience member at the CSO.
Like... how many distractions are there for you as an audience member at a Beyoncé concert? And but you're still appreciating, like, exactly how you put it, the, like, pleasure, the, like, the... That's a weird way of putting it. What I mean... You didn't say it this way.
I forgot specifically. Well, they were, yeah.
Yeah, right, right, exactly. They're not going upstairs to have the quickie, right?
It's just there, you know. That's right. Grant Park does a pretty good job of this, though.
I agree.
Like, I think, you know, they present, like, Chichester Psalms. They present these wonderful things. And people go out and, like, they just have a picnic. Some of them get a little sloshed, you know? Although, Brandy and I have a funny story. The first summer that I moved here, our mutual friend who introduced us came up for an audition, and we all went down to Chinatown, and we got some desserts, and we came up to watch Night Out at the Opera. And we were standing along the railing.
The seated area.
Yeah. Yeah. And we would reach in to grab, like, you know, like an egg tart or something, and this woman next to us kept hushing us because we were reaching in. It's like, you're talking to three professional musicians who are trying to eat at an outside part and, like, pay for the ticket if you want absolute silence. It was ridiculous how even in that scenario, people had this weird concept of how should
I'll jump in here because, like, you know, something I've been interested in actually is, I call it the performance practice of performing. But there was a, an account that I read about, you know, Franz Liszt's salon concerts, and that he, if it was totally silent, to him it meant that nobody liked it, you know, and he was actually, like, that was not good. Mm-hmm. And people shouted and, you know, all kinds of things. And so, I mean, again, we're not trying to do something exactly like somebody else, but knowing that those kinds of experiences were being had, and that classical music didn't always have this, you know, let's just say fixed idea about how it should go. And I mean that in a lot of different ways, again, I'm looking at, you know, pop music, folk music, other genres of music that still are able to accomplish the social element today. For whatever reason, classical has, you know, gone in and out of that social element. But, I mean, really, I think, you know, it really does kind of come down to what is the focus, and what is, you know, what are you really trying to do when you have a performance?
Yeah.
Because I can tell you this, my husband's not a musician, right? So he comes to a concert, he's like, yeah, it was all great, it sounds great, you know. But before he says that, though, he'll say, well, the seats weren't comfortable, or this was weird about, you know, whatever. He'll comment on something that, you know, wasn't about the music. And I think about the fact that a lot of times, you know, we're talking, it's funny because all these articles and things that are all these discussions, right, are amongst musicians. But it's, you know, important to remember that the majority of the people are not us, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a perspective about it. And so it's kind of like, all right, so, you know, whose perspective should we be paying attention to more? Is it the people? I mean, you know, and I've had this conversation with people, just to be transparent about the fact that, like, you know, who truly is your audience? Is it your teachers? Is it your other peers or colleagues that are also classical musicians? Or is it the one that bought the ticket to come see you? You know,
yeah.
Like, who are you really playing to? Is your, and this is not to say that someone's perspective is not valid, you know, because there is a, like I said, there is still a certain part of classical music that is to be embraced, right? But I am saying this, though, that if you're constantly talking about how we need to appeal to different demographics, we need to be able to appeal to people, blah, 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 all this stuff, you can't have this dissonance of, well, I'm never going to change, and these people should just come, you know?
Right.
So
the
expectation
that people just come to
you. Yeah. It's just kind of like, there's definitely a dissonance in, like, that kind of thinking. And so I have no problem calling people out on that, you know, just to say, like, you can totally have what, you know, you can have the experience that you want. And you can make the concert be what you want. Just know that there is a select group of people that agree with you, and then there's, you know, the majority of the world that doesn't see it the way you do. And you know, there's and that's a fact. Mm-hmm. For real. I've had this said to me before, and I agree with it on some levels, and I agree with it not on some levels, which is that in order to appreciate art, you must educate yourself in it. And so it's kind of like, all right, well, there's many different components to that statement, right? First of all, what is the definition of appreciate? What are you talking about? Do they need to know that, like, all the little nuances in order to fully appreciate? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a certain level of appreciation. Are they, you know, are you talking about just mere enjoyment? Or are you talking about, you know, I mean, what exactly about that experience do you want people to, I mean, what is your definition of appreciate? And then what is your definition of educate? Because, you know, even amongst the classical music community, we don't always agree. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's really rare that we do, right? On things like interpretation, or how should we execute this piece, or this, you know, and in the early music community, most, like, you know, there's kind of this, like, you know, going back to the treatises, how do we do, you know, these various, like, performance practices, this ornamentation, and making sure that it matches, you know, all of these, you know, subtle and meticulous things, which are good to pursue. Excellence is always good to pursue. But then, what is your ultimate goal, though? Mm-hmm. You know, and if your ultimate goal is to not just bring in the same people that like classical music, if it, then, you know, your goal, your, the way you do things has to change. Mm-hmm. If you're cool with just doing things like you like it, and keeping classical music, like, I mean, if you're current with its current, if you're good with its current state of affairs, then yeah, keep doing it. And I'm glad you have that conviction. I respect it for sure. I respect anybody that has a strong conviction about what they're doing.
And
but
I think that ties, yeah, back to, like, one of the original questions you had, right, about what are the tenets of the things that we do. Yeah. And Brandy gave, right, a great answer. And I just to add to that was, like, I think one of the things that we want to do is, can we create art and create a space that everybody says accessible? So I really, right, hesitate to say that because I don't think it means anything,
well,
to people.
I'll tell you what, a lot of people say, I'm going to be accessible, I'm going to, yeah, be innovative, I'm going to be all these things, right? But my point just being that if you want something different, you have to do different. If you want it to be the same, then just be cool with the same, but don't say that it's innovative. Don't say that it's, you know, whatever, I have my unique artistic voice, whatever you want to call it, right? I mean, it, like, I'm being a little controversial at the moment talking.
No,
but
no,
I'm just saying, yeah, you know, if you want a result, you can't just do the same. If you want a different result, if you want to attract different people, if you want to expand, if you want more people to like classical music and come to your concerts, then maybe look into doing something slightly different.
But one of our tenants is like, if would we enjoy going to this show? I'm a hard ticket to sell because, like, if I go to a show, it means because either it was something just really, that really captured me, that I was like, wow, I don't think I'll ever see that again, or the people who in it I really care about and I want to go show them that I'm committed to them, right? That's usually why I go to a show. So, like, well, what would attract me to a show? Well, first of all of these things, you know, kind of like the weird angles, and then also just kind of the environment and the kind of, the environment that we try to create. I think that's the tenet, is like, is this something that a normal person like Brandy's husband, Brian, would enjoy going to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, so we recently produced an event. It was a 24-hour concert where,
yeah,
composers had 12 hours to write a piece for an ensemble that they selected at random, and then that ensemble had 12 hours to learn it, and then we performed it at the end of the night. And
wow,
it was very cool. And what I liked about it is that we had 7 composers. A few of them were classical composers. And then a few of them, like, we had one we had one person who does more like singer-songwriter stuff. We had one person who does more experimental stuff. And it was a real, it was a very cool like blend of genre. Like we had some true like classical pieces, and then we had some that were not classical. And what I liked about it is looking out into the audience, I saw Chicago theater artists. I saw Chicago classical musicians. I saw members of the like DIY music scene out there. And if we had focused in on just one of on attracting any just one of those subsets of people, we would have a third of the audience.
Yeah.
And so I think that like being comfortable with flexibility is so hugely important. And I think that it's something that like people are, you know, people we hear all the time like, oh, our audience is dwindling, our audience is dwindling. It's because you're not willing to expand what you think your audience should be.
Right. And to that end, just to plug our composers, because they are, I mean, they're super awesome. We do have all spectrums. Like Kurt is, you know, he's the classical guy, the classical guru. Ronnie had classical training for sure, but when you listen to her music, so I would say like, you know, Kurt would be, you know, that end of the new music spectrum that's just like, you know, I mean, his music is awesome. And you know, he would exemplify, I guess, the classical end of that spectrum for us. And then I would say like, you know, kind of towards, you know, a little bit to her, like Ronnie has that classical, but she is very much inspired by tango music. So all of her music has that flavor to it. You know, it's all very charming and it has that vignette kind of like, I just, when I hear her music, I imagine like sitting in the park under a little umbrella with my little picnic basket, you know, like by a pond or something very picturesque. There's something about, and then also at the same time, she channels in that occasional like fiery aspect of the tango too, you know, like, so there's that, you know, kind of influence that she has in her music. Regina has a very soulful blues gospel background in her music. And so what you're going to hear at Chicago Stories has like these three different, you know, elements. And what I love also about this, I didn't mention this before about the project, is that because people are writing about the different communities in Chicago, each of the soundscapes that you're getting is flavored, you know, by the South Side, by, you know, the, you know, Wicker Park area, by the, you know, Swedish. Last year we had, you know, the Assyrian side of things, and also
Eric studied like classical and folk forms all the way to
it was like he like also incorporated pop songs, and then Amos, he's like had the Latin jazz background, so his pieces had that Latin jazz flavor in it. So and that was something that's really cool about the different, and you know, we have a roster of personnel, but each of the composers also gets to choose. It's not a set instrumentation, so therefore they get the ability to be different from the other composers, and they get to kind of showcase a little bit more towards that flavor that they're writing, you know, for that specific community. So
that's actually fun. Your 24 hours, it's very similar to Chicago Stories, only it's like a boot camp, like sort of scenario instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and the thing that we've totally gone over, but there's more that I want to talk about. So there's one last thing I'm going to kind of like touch on, which is something that that I don't know if we've said a lot, but I do know is a underpinning theme to Scoppy in 2018, which is the idea of praxis. Are you familiar with that? It comes from political theory, but what it really is, and because I think it's generally,
I just know praxis from the test I had to take for like teacher certification. So I'm like, that brings back terrible memories.
Well, I'll tell you why. So what it means is, because you know, people can talk theory all day. You know, they're very smart people that have really well understanding of theory, but then to then turn around and make something. That theory doesn't always come up in practice. Back it up. So the idea of praxis is how does your theory show up in practice specifically? And you know, there are definite moments where I know that a lot of the people, like praxis group that we had on the podcast, like a pile of teeth, where you see actual practice where you see like people taking what they know to be right about, or maybe not, let's not go right or wrong, right? Let's go what they prioritize as a person individually, but seeing how it can actually manifest in production, that I think is like, to me, that is like the thing I think y'all do in spades, is that level of not just being aware of what's happening theoretically, both in your classical training and in your kind of like folk training, and but also in your like social awareness training, but then taking all of that, right, and not necessarily like feeling an overwhelming need to comment on it, but rather to make something that's very meaningful and that is also exemplary of those values. And I think that, so I don't actually have a question there, but what I am saying is that I'm glad for this moment to just kind of like verbalize that, because it's nice to recognize that, because that was a personal, you know, 2016, 2017, or did we start in 2017?
Yeah, beginning of 2017.
We were mostly theoretical, and I think that in a lot of ways, the way we covered, we did good, but I think that we've made changes in MO that has meant that we've had mayoral candidates on the show, that we've had like a mother of someone who was murdered by the police, we've had these moments that in actual practice that have exemplified where we come from ideologically. And you have to do that. Like, you have to, like, you can have intentions all day, but like there is a moment in which you have to go, are my intentions actually coming up when you look back,
yeah, in the end result.
Yeah, in the end result.
I think that goes back to what Brandy said, and we talk about that. This is kind of like a lot of people say that they want to do something, but then it's like they don't actually commit to doing it. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, what really was your priority here? Like, are you actually prioritizing doing something different? If you didn't, then you probably weren't prioritizing that, right? Like, and there's nothing wrong to say that. But I think that's, yeah, I think for us, like, the big thing is, like, how, if we see this issue, right? I assume we all in this room kind of agree there's an issue with kind of the classical world.
Yeah.
So, like, what do we do about it? The only thing you can do is to actually try to do something rather than just sit around and mope about it.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So that's all I got on that one.
Yeah. I do just go back to, what is it you're trying to do and what are you actually doing to get there?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, you know, this idea of audience development, appealing to certain demographics, is, you know, that in of itself is just a symptom of something greater. Mm-hmm. You know, like whenever Thomas and I do something, our mindset about why we want to do it is not to solve the problem of building our audience base or, you know, whatever. We feel that if we're pursuing the thing we feel like, the things we feel passionate about and we have a focus about it, the audience development will take care of itself. The brand awareness will take care of itself. You know, obviously, it doesn't mean we just sit and do nothing. Like, we're hard at work all the time. But it just means that, you know, if our goal is to reach outside of those, you know, that community of people who have already said, I love classical music, I go to, you know, I'm a CSM subscriber to CSO, Lyric, whatever, or I just, you know, if our goal truly is to reach outside of those, you know, of that group of people, then we're gonna just do differently. You know, our goal was never to be CSO, it was never to be Lyric. And if your goal is to be one of them, then yeah, all the best to you. They're great organizations. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at what they do. And there's a reason that they have, you know, the brand that they have. And there's a reason they have the audience that they have. And there's no right or wrong about that. It's, they're being true to what they are.
Right.
You know? And so I think like the biggest thing for me is just for the classical world, I think, you know, there's always, I'll speak from the bluegrass camp for just a second, just because I saw this in that camp too. You always are going to have the purist, if you will, the traditional, the traditionalists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need that part. We need that part of the genre that kind of keeps things, you know, yeah, I mean, and they're going to pursue that, and that's good. As long as you're, like, totally convicted about that, and you're going to appeal to the people who want that too, all the best to you. That's awesome. And then in that same genre, you have the people, like, the new grassers, you know, the progressives, if you will. You know, all the best to them too. They're going to, you know, push the genre to new boundaries, you know, and they're going to push it to different places that the traditionalists aren't. But, you know, the traditionalists are going to hold on to things that maybe the progressives let go a little too easily. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I think, you know, in any genre, it's good to have both. But what I see in the classical world is, you know, sometimes even the big dogs, you know, are trying to make themselves not, you know, they're in an effort to, we need to build more audience. They're not staying true to what their original substance is. Or what they, you know, it's almost like false advertising. We saw this, like, I saw this, like, ad of, like, Beethoven smashing a cello or something.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, come on, you know.
Like, yeah, who was it? Was that like, the CSO that did that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to totally call
it. A lot of people went wild about that. Actually, a lot of people were like, what is this? Like,
yeah,
this
right.
is the most ridiculous
yeah.
thing.
And you know, and it just goes to show, like, hey, just be true to whatever it is you're doing, right? And you should do it with all the conviction that you have. And keep that. And so, you know, so that's all I mean is, like, if there's a certain result that you're already getting or you want that somebody else is getting, you just do that thing. But don't say, like, hey, I'm going to go outside of this, but then, you know, make sure that you're what you are, say you're trying to do, and then what you're actually doing match up.
And also try to do, I think, sorry, and also just try to do stuff too. Like, yeah. One of the things I was thinking when she was talking about it, one of the things that I think we like about you guys is it's cool because you think about different kinds of programming, you think mm-hmm. about different ways you can reach people, you think about different kinds of ways of creating art, right? Because a podcast is art, the way that you do things is art. Mm-hmm. So, and I think about some colleagues who complain about nobody coming to their shows, and they're like, well, people should just come. People, there's free music all around Chicago. Why don't people just come? And it's like, well, you know, just because you put it out there doesn't mean people will come. You have to work very hard at it. Mm-hmm. You have to work to build a relationship with people. You have to work very hard to build a voice and build something worthwhile for people to come. You can't just play pretty. And
yeah, they don't teach you that in music school.
Yeah,
you know?
But I think that that's also yeah. like a very valuable thing too. Like you have to put something out there not only that's worthwhile, but then you have to go chasing for it. You have to make sure people are going to come to you as well. I forget how that prompted my idea, so maybe that
yeah,
seems
yeah,
out of
I
place,
don't know.
But okay.
But you should come to Chicago Stories because well, Chicago Stories is, you know, that's, yeah.
We've definitely gone over it. It's been really, really thoughtful conversation. Thank you all so much. The last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1-minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes it's very obvious, like letting people know where they can find out more about an upcoming performance series. Otherwise, we love hearing shout outs to other folks that are doing dope work or any media that you're consuming, self-care, otherwise, music, TV shows, stuff like that.
Brandy, cool. Why don't you talk about the show and then I'll talk how they can find us.
All right, awesome. So we have 3 shows coming up. The first show is Saturday, September 29th at 6:30 p.m. at Loyola Park in Rogers Park area. The second show is Saturday, October 6th at 6:30 p.m. This will be in Bridgeport at the Armour Square Park, right across the street from Sox Stadium. And then the third performance is at the Den Theater in Wicker Park. So
cool.
Yes.
Yeah. And then to find out information about it, you should definitely hit up our website, which is, so we're the Bach and Beethoven Experience. And the website is B as in boy, experience.org. BBExperience.org.
BB.
You also can find us, you can just Google Bach and Beethoven, and we're like right up at the top, like on Google. So we're really happy about that. Also, of course, social media, of course, Facebook, SoundCloud, Twitter, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. But definitely go to the website, and a link to our landing page for Chicago Stories 2 is right at the top, and you can get tickets there. But the two parks are free, and then the Den Theater is a special treat, so there's beer and stuff that's there too. So that it's a little bit of a price tag for that one.
We should mention a shout out to Night Out in the Parks for picking our project up this year for those two performances at Loyola Park and at Armour Square Park.
And
a huge shout out and thanks to the Den Theater for having us again. That's going to be super awesome. The owner he's awesome. He's super cool. So and that one specifically is a ticketed event. It's $15 general admission. All of the information on the website. And then of course you can hear Thomas has put up a video about last year's Chicago story, so you could see it's like a featurette basically of how it all came together. And a shout out to the Tribeca Flashpoint College folks for putting that together, and a special shout out to Yuri, sound engineer. So
yeah.
Oh hell yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Dan Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our podcasts and articles there, as well as all of our videos. Otherwise, you can find us on social media. On Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board. It's a really nice space for conversations about local memes and art and politics and astrology. It's a weird space. It's really fun. Otherwise, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, and you can also find the podcast, the one that you're listening to right now, under Scopy Radio in most podcast places, including iTunes, Google Play, and Radio Public.
And I'm here to talk about the importance of subscribing. If you head to our website, scopymag.com, and go to our subscribe page, there are a couple ways that you can do that. The first is to sign up for email blasts. This is huge because even though we post across social media platforms, Facebook buries our content. So if you want to see 100% of what we're doing and not just 30% of it, I suggest that you sign up for those email blasts. The second thing you can do is you can become a member. For as little as $5 a month, you can help us do fun things like keep our lights on and pay our artists. There are some cool incentives associated with becoming a member, so please do check that out. The other thing, the time-sensitive thing, the thing that we feel self-conscious about, is that we have an Indiegogo campaign going on right now. We're trying to upgrade some of our equipment. We've never done one of these before, and so if you are in a position to give, if you're feeling flush this month, if you feel sorry for us, I don't care why you feel compelled to give. Just please, if you're able to, please do so. So
and on our Facebook page.
It's on our Facebook page, yeah. And if you have any questions about why we're doing it, please, please, please feel free to ask. So give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.